Aquí.
So, before we do the questions, dear Ajahn, do you mind signing the books we are planning to sell at the end of this retreat? I will sign any book except a checkbook. If so, can you please make an announcement to the effect? Yes. So, any books you want to sign except for checkbooks, I will do that for you. Dear Ajahn, what is contentment? Simple question, but it's amazing how people don't know what contentment is. Compassion, kindness, what's kindness? These are the things we assume we know. And those assumptions, thinking we know, stops us really understanding what these things are. So contentment is where you are just happy to be here and you don't want anything else in the whole world. If you found a bottle and a genie came out and said, I'll give you 3 wishes, and you sit there and say, no thank you. That's called contentment. Well, you don't want anything, you don't wish for anything. This may not be the best place or the best mind or the best body, but it is good enough. This beautiful sense that I don't need anything, I don't want anything. And that's such a beautiful mind state. Where would you rather be if you did have a wish and you could go anywhere in the world right now? Would it be other than sitting on your mat in Jhana Grove? If you're happy to be here, it's called contentment. If your mind is not the best, but it's good enough, that's called contentment. If your wife is not the best, but it's good enough. Your husband, oh, but you know, they're all the same, so it's good enough. And your monk is good enough, the nun's good enough, then you're content. And that's the most important thing. When you don't want anything, that's called contentment. It's happiness. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. This is amazing, just beautiful jhana grove, but you still want something more. That means you can't enjoy it. When you're happy to have it here, this is good enough. You don't want anything in the whole world. The end of craving, contentment. It's a very beautiful word. How to settle greed and jealousy in the mind. It's what do you want, greed? How much do you want? If I could give you $1 million, US, would that be enough? You think it would be, wouldn't you? But you get people like Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, they still have to work every day. It's crazy, isn't it? You think they've got so much money, they can just let go and retire and be easy, but no, it's more work. And so, how to settle greed and jealousy in mind? One of my stories, that as a monk, I'm not allowed to receive any money. So any donations go into the box for Jhana Grove or wherever. But there is a loophole. There's always loopholes in any legal code. And that is, you can't give me any money, but you can say, I have $100 here. I won't give it to you, but whatever you want for $100, anything personal. I give money to monastery, but this is for you. Is anything you need personal? That is allowable. But don't do it. Because it happened to me long time ago when I was in Thailand, young monk. I'd really helped somebody. And they said, look, thank you, thank you, thank you. Now I want to, I give donations to monastery, bring food, but I want something just to give to you out of gratitude. You've helped me so much. So he said, I have 100 baht. I will keep it, so you don't have to break your precepts, but you tell me what you want for 100 baht. What do you need? And then I started thinking, my mind was blank. So I thinking, and he said, come on, I've got to go to work. So I had the idea, look, I will think about that this evening, and you come tomorrow about the same time, and I'll give you a list of what I want for 100 baht. That may not sound very much, but 42 years ago, when you're living in a forest monastery where you don't need much anyway, that was a lot of money. So that evening, I went back into my room in my hut, and I actually didn't have any paper. I actually used, honestly, the covering of a mosquito coil. And the inside was plain. So, and I got an old pencil out, and I thought, what do I want? 100 baht. So first thing, like a little exercise book. I took a proper paper so I can write things on. And the old pencil I was using was hopeless, but just a simple ballpoint pen. Nothing fancy, no, not a Mont Blanc or a Parker, just an ordinary little ballpoint pen so I can write properly. And I was writing by a candlelight, and that's really bad for your eyes. So I thought the next thing would be one of these little oil lamps, a cheap one, nothing expensive. But also, if you have an oil lamp, you know, you do need some matches, because the matches I had were just hopeless. And when I was thinking of matches, I thought, actually, I also need some batteries for my flashlight. So I put down batteries. And because, you know, you're in the forest. There's snakes and other things around there. And, you know, they're very nice snakes, but when they see a toad, they don't know the difference between a toad and their dinner. So, you know, dangerous. And actually, not just a flashlight, but my thongs were falling apart, so I put down thongs. And then I quickly looked, and what I put down there was more than 100 baht. And so I had to take something off, and I couldn't. These were all important. How could I live without these things? And as I was thinking what I can take off, then I thought of other things. I actually need some stamps and some aerograms so I can write to my mother. And then I need something else, and I saw what was going on. So what I did, I screwed up the piece of paper and threw it away. And when that guy came the next day, I told him, don't you ever do that to me again. Before I had, you know, the worth of 100 baht, I was so happy and content because I couldn't buy anything. I didn't even think about it. But now I had the possibility of 100 baht's worth of stuff. It wasn't enough. And the longer I thought, there's always something else, which it wasn't just I wanted, it was necessary. I really needed it once I thought about it. And I realized that that is how greed starts. When you don't have any means to buy anything, you're so happy and content. So that was my lesson in just greed. You can justify it. It's really important. I really need this. It's good for my health. There's snakes around. I need this. But what's more important was my contentment. So never ever do that to a monk. Don't come up to me and say, Ajahn Brahm, what do you want? I'll say, nothing. No, come on, I want to get you something. Something for you. I say, no, I don't need anything. I know it's so wonderful when people come up to you and say things like that. What can I get you? I say, nothing. I don't need anything. That's called contentment. No greed. And as for jealousy, oh my goodness. Just, isn't it wonderful that other people get enlightened before you? So amazing, because that's the Bodhisattva. I was saying this the other day, I thought about it, you know, because, you know, you see that sometimes I like to open doors for you, and some of you are so traditional, saying, no, you can't have my teacher open the door for me, I've got to open the door for my teacher. You're a monk, you're a senior monk, I can't just go through when you're opening the door. And it reminded me just of a long time ago when I started looking at Mahayana Buddhism. They have the idea of the Bodhisattva. And a Bodhisattva, especially, is someone who says they will not get enlightened until even the last blade of grass is enlightened. They will be the very, very last. And then I started thinking, there's actually quite a few of these Bodhisattvas. There's Amitabha, there's Manjushri. There's Avalokiteshvara, I said Avalokiteshvara, and who else is there? Amitabha. And I thought, at the end of the time, when everybody else is enlightened, and only the Bodhisattvas left, there'll be a big argument. Now, after you, you'll be enlightened first. Now, I made the resolution that I'll be the last one, but so did I. So there'll be this big traffic jam at the end of time, when all these Bodhisattvas who all made the promise I would be the last, not the equal last, but the last, and they wouldn't be able to go. Because they'd be breaking their vows. Anyway, I think you get what I mean. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned that you used to help other monks in their chores and spent less time in meditation as compared to them. After those chores, wouldn't you feel tired and still able to have time to meditate? Amazing, you may have experienced this as well. Sometimes physically you're tired, but mentally you're just so inspired. You've done something really beautiful. You've helped people. And yeah, you're really tired. Again, a story. Young monks in those times, before they ordained as bhikkhus, as monks, we had to make a full set of three robes from scratch, from white cloth. Sewing it, washing it, making the dye, and then dyeing it. And the dye was made out of jackfruit wood. And it was a labor intensive. So there was a group of, I forget whether it was three or four monks, were making their robes in order, they were novices, in order to have the full ordination. And they'd already been up for 2 nights without sleep. And so another evening without sleep, and they were supposed to do it themselves. That's how labor intensive, how long it was. It was like a little exercise in endurance. So after the evening meeting, I went to the dyeing shed and said to these guys, look, I know this is against the rules, but you go and take a rest. I look after the dye pot tonight for you. And they never argued. They went straight away. Because you know what it's like when you haven't slept for such a long time. It's really sort of, very painful. Not sort of physically painful, but just emotionally. You just can't wait to hit the sack. So I looked after the dye pot all night myself. I never slept that night. Working hard, and in the morning, 3 o'clock bell, and just after that they came, and thank you so much, just a few hours sleep was all we needed, and I went off to the morning chanting and meditation, and I never had so much energy. I mentioned that because it was very hot, sometimes I had sloth and torpor, put matchboxes on my head. That morning, no sleepiness at all, powerful chanting. And I was so energized, and I could not understand why. I hadn't slept all night, working hard, physically tired, but so much energy. And I asked the other monk who was there at the time, the senior monk, what's going on? He said, that's what happens when you help other people. When you're selfless, you don't think about yourself, but someone else needs a hand, and you just give it. You don't really think about yourself. Instant karmic reward. Huge energy. So I didn't realize that at the time, what I was doing, why it works, but it always does. If you get tired just doing stuff for yourself, you don't get much mental energy. But when you do it serving others, you get heaps of energy. And so often I do that. I do work very hard, and sometimes when I am physically tired, because I've been running around all over the world sometimes, and then you think, what have I just done? What have I done today? And all the beautiful Dhamma, the interviews, really caring for people, trying to do the very best, and all the other stuff I do as well. And I felt, wow, this is beautiful. I've had a beautiful day. I've helped and served so many people. Just as I don't know if you saw them, it was just in the interview this morning, there was a Vietnamese family. They flew all the way from Adelaide just to see me, because they had been going through marital problems and psychological problems. And the psychologist said, watch me on YouTube. And the YouTube videos had just saved their marriage and saved his life as well. Beautiful couple came with their kid. And he said, as soon as he saw me, he said, I just want to cry. And gratitude. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And those sorts of things, doesn't matter how tired you are, you get this huge boost of energy. Karma, really good stuff you've been doing, helping people big time. And that's actually how, you get energized. So yeah, I was doing lots of chores with these other monks, but what a wonderful thing to do. Because, my idea was, I was making sure that these monks didn't need to be bothered with going to Bangkok to do their visas. I'll do it for them. So they can be in the jungles and in their caves and enjoy the meditation. And the thing was, I got more energy out of that than they did. So that's actually how it works. Giving, selfless, compassion. it works. So don't be selfish and be jealous. Oh, that drains energy. Oh, why are they in the jungle meditating? I'm so happy they're in the jungle meditating while I'm working. And that type of attitude is, and fortunately, I think I have instilled that in Bodhinyana Monastery. There's chores to be done, but somebody else does your chores for you. So, you know, it's your job to wash up. But when you get there, it's already been washed up. Ha ha, I got there first. So the chores aren't something which is a burden. It's a privilege. And that is just changes, makes it much more fun. Oh, why do I have to clean the toilets every week? Why do I have to do this? Now I say, wow. I know it's not my turn, but I'm going to do it. That attitude is so much fun. Anyway, what happened to the tattooed biker and ex-heroin addict who got into deep meditation? Do they become monks after such bliss? I don't know what happened to them. The tattooed biker disappeared, and the ex-heroin addict, unfortunately, he just got back into heroin because it was very difficult. But who cares what happened to them? When they were there, they had a beautiful meditation. You don't need to know what happened to them afterwards. What happened to them then was good. And eventually, they'll deep meditation, they'll sort of get off their heroin, maybe not this lifetime, next lifetime. The tattooed biker, I don't know where he's gone, but he obviously had incredible ability. Who knows where he goes, but he's obviously got something there. Could a loud sound trigger deep meditation? A very senior monk said that when he was a lay man on his third sitting, there was a loud bang of the door to the quiet meditation hall, and he went into a deep state of meditation. This hasn't worked for any of you, has it? I think because people don't bang the doors loud enough. So can you please try banging the doors loud for the next 24 hours and see if it works? Is that a good idea? People say no, that's very unlikely. I don't know what he meant by a deep meditation, but that sounds very strange to me. I can't understand that. Because usually you've got to turn the sound off, and that just a loud sound just keeps it going. Dear Ajahn, if someone close, e.g. parent, passed away, how do we have joy? Does it mean we'll never have jhana? Look, my mother passed away 5 years ago, and when I heard the news, I was happy. The reason was, she had dementia for about 3 years, and that's no life when you have dementia. So for me, it was like she was released from her prison. And you know, when someone gets released from prison, of course you're happy. So my mum was free. So that's why I thought it was wonderful. I didn't have sadness. I thought, at last, she hasn't got a dementia anymore. So that's, you know, even someone close to you who dies, lived a beautiful life. And sometimes they get a nice rebirth. If you have sadness, it's sadness for yourself. It's selfishness. It's not sadness for them. They're free. So think of other people. Think of your parents. Don't think of yourself. Oh, I miss her. Oh, I need my father. That's selfishness. Let them go. Be selfless. The greatest act of love is to let someone go. Dear Ajahn, why was there a ranger at Jhana Grove this morning? Thank you very much. That was not a ranger. That was prison officer. Because we have prisoners who are actually doing voluntary work at Jhana Grove. They're actually building a bridge down the bottom over there. So, I don't know what they've done. Murderers, thieves, violent rapists working right next to you. But no, these are really, really good ones. Because they're supervised. You know that once we had a retreat here, and one of the prisoners was a cook, Carl. And he was a very, very bad guy, if you look at actually what he did. But he was out there cooking the food all by himself. You know, just honestly, please excuse me, Bianca, but it made Bianca look lazy. did everything. She's out and back now, she's not there, thank goodness. And he was making these pizzas the dough all by himself and everything else, as well as so many other dishes. And I couldn't believe just how, and he was just big smile on his face. He enjoyed every minute of it. And, you know, it was only after the retreat I said, you know who that guy was? You know, he's a really bad criminal. He said, oh, come on. It was. But, you know, it's just a really nice guy. Give him a chance to do some good karma. So that's what those were. And the prison officer there was just to make sure they behaved. So it was okay. You know, one of our monks used to be a prisoner over at Carnet. Which one was it? It wasn't me. A really nice guy. You know, just you get into a bit of trouble every now and again. But, you know, give people a chance. Is that a good idea, having an ex-prisoner as a monk? Of course, Angulimala. You know, he was a serial killer and he became a great arahant. So that's why we have forgiveness. So it wasn't a ranger, it was a prison officer. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how do you tell your mind to do something, e.g. wake up at 4:20? Last night I told my mind to wake me up at 4:20 in the morning yesterday, but instead it woke me up at 6:45, which made me late for breakfast. Help me, please. I want to wake up on time, not earlier or later. How do you do it so easily? Thank you very much. Well, you tell your mind, if you want to get up at 4:20, tell your mind to set the alarm clock at 4:20. I missed that bit out, didn't I? Now, what you normally do is set your alarm clock at, say, 4:25, just in case. And then set your mind 4:20. And you've got to really say it clearly and mean it. Mind, wake up at 4:20 a.m. Not, you've got it precise, otherwise it gets 4:20 p.m. Mind, wake up at 4:20 a.m. Mind, wake up at 4:20 a.m. Say it, mean it, listen very carefully, attentively, with as much mindfulness, so silence, and then just forget about it. And most times it does work. But 4:25, the alarm, just in case. Okay, dear Ajahn, can you please tell a story? Do you want a ghost story? What story do you want? Any other story? Okay, this was an Australian who went to visit England. And as he was visiting England, he went into one of the old English pubs. And those pubs are hundreds of years old. And as he went into the pub, he was surprised. No one was there except the barman. And even he could feel the atmosphere was pretty spooky. It wasn't sort of one of these happy pubs. It was really, you know, you feel that maybe you shouldn't be there. So he ordered a glass of beer and he sat down at one of these seats in a corner of the pub. And as he was sitting there, no one else was there at all except the barman. He heard somebody say, "Nice jacket you're wearing." He looked around. There was no one there. So he sipped his beer and thought, just imagination. And then he heard it say, "Nice pair of shoes too." He looked, no one. Under the table, there was no microphone. It wasn't a gag or a trick. So, you know, he carried on sipping his beer, but he was a bit scared by now. And then he heard it again. "And nice hairstyle you're wearing there." And that was it. No one was there at all. And so he put his glass of beer down, only a tiny bit drunk, and rushed outside the pub. And just as he was passing the bar, and about, "Where are you going? You haven't finished your beer yet." "Look, there was no one in the bar, and three times I heard somebody talk." And the barman said, "What do they say? What do they say?" And they said, "I'm wearing a nice jacket, I'm wearing good shoes, a nice hairstyle." And the barman said, "Oh, that's the peanuts. They're complimentary." " That should stop you asking any more stories. In a bar, peanuts are complimentary. They're free. Yes, terrible. If I told a good joke, I'll ask for another one, so this is going to stop you. As you said, an emitter can be sparkling or gloomy. Similarly, at the time of death, when the five senses shut down, there can be a sparkling or gloomy emitter, and a rebirth will depend on this emitter. Is that correct? Not so much a gloomy emitter, but it can be just, you know, a few, what's it called, stains on it, because you haven't been living a good life. So, it's that nimitta, that light, the virtue, your goodness. But you know, most people are virtuous, most people are okay. You know, sometimes people are just so tough on themselves. But most people are fine people. There's this lady I was counselling, Australian lady, she had cancer. So she was going to die, so she went to the experts. If you want to know about death, you have to go to a Buddhist. You know, because we believe in reincarnation, so we've died many times. You go to a Christian, they've only died once, so what do they know? You know, we've got experience. It's only a joke, reincarnation. So anyway, one day, I was in Nonamara, just doing a bit of counselling for her. I asked her, you know, she got to know me and trust me, and I said, what's the worst thing you've ever done in your life? The worst thing. Because, you know, we've all got some hidden secrets, and it's nice before we die to let somebody know so we can actually get some forgiveness. But more than that, so we can actually keep it in perspective. And know what she said, the worst thing, she was about 70, 75, she said the worst thing she ever did is, you know, she was married, and she kissed somebody else's husband. And she said that it took so long to get it out of her. She felt so guilty. And I looked at her and said, if that's the worst you've ever done in your whole life, that's not a bad life you've lived. And when she actually told me, she could listen to herself, and something she felt so guilty about for such a long time, now because it was out in the open, it wasn't so bad. So she could die more peacefully. So that's why sometimes it's good to actually, whatever you've done which is bad, now let a good monk know. I did promise I would never tell anybody. So be careful with Ajahn Brahm. Go and tell one of the nuns or somebody. But then when you actually bring it out, you feel so much relief. Because, you know, most of the time you realize it's not that bad. So that means that you can die peacefully. So that's why the nimitta then will be much brighter. You won't be emphasizing the nasty side. But anyway, if you play around with nimittas now, you know, you do the focusing on the beautiful part of it and zooming in on the bright, beautiful part. So you can turn a stained nimitta into a beautiful nimitta and have a beautiful life. Rebirth. As per your instructions, I focused on peace instead of the breath and had a few seconds of peace. But it soon became dullness, because you were focusing on the dullness. I let it be, and dullness becomes my best friend. Oh, here we go. It follows me on every meditation sitting. Please help me to find another more useful friend. Thank you. What do you mean? Dullness is marvelous. So, when you're dull, like that, it means that, you have no aspirations, you should have hardly any thoughts, because when you're dull, you can't worry about anything. You have no thoughts of the future and no thoughts of the past. You're too dull to think of things like that. So think of all the benefits of dullness. So think, dullness is so great. I don't overeat. I'm too dull to have craving and greed. I can sleep really well, because if you're really excited, it's hard to sleep at night. But if you're dull, it's so easy to sleep. So there's many advantages of being dull. And when you're dull, you're not using up much energy, so you probably live a long life. Because my theory is, you've only got a certain amount of energy. Like, you've got a car, you've only got so much petrol or so many miles. And if you use that car for long distances, of course it's not going to last that long. So if you use the car only just a few kilometers a year, it will last forever. So when you're dull, you're not using your brain all that fast and all that hard, so of course it will have longevity. So because of that, you know, just think of all the advantages of dullness. And when you think of all the advantages of Dharma, you say, oh wow, it really is a friend. It's very, very beautiful. And once you're happy to be dull, the dullness is gone. You've transformed it with your attitude. But when you think, I don't want to be dull, I hate dullness, that's when it gets worse. So welcome dullness. Dullness, thank you for coming. So many advantages. And if you don't think that dullness will give you long life, my secret, it's obvious, if you want to live a long life, you drink a lot of long life milk. It says so on the packet. Have a look. It said long life milk. So that must give you long life. When meditating, what happens if I suddenly sneeze? Will that break the meditation? Of course it does. You get so close to jhanas and then you blow it.
You're nice.
Do I stay seated or do I also do walking meditation? You can do either. So you sneeze, one sneeze and it's finished. But if you keep thinking about it, oh, I sneeze, I shouldn't have sneezed, why did I sneeze? That's really bad. Then, of course, it's the thinking which really disturbs the meditation, not the sneeze. And it's the same with the people who hear the sneeze. They hear the sneeze and say, these are banned people. You should have, like, in the airports, you know, when there's SARS or bird flu, you can actually see these little cameras, they focus on you. And if you've got a fever, they take you aside. And I don't know what they do to you, but, you know, they take you aside and actually see, you know, whether you've got a fever or not. So we should have those in Jhana Grove. Have it in the entrance here. Anyone who's got a fever, you take outside so they will never sneeze here in this hall. And you're allowed maybe three sneezes. No, you've got to be compassionate. The third sneeze, that's it, out, and you're banned for the next year. Should we do that? That's stupid. It's only a sneeze, a small thing, that's all. And don't have to worry about just, ooh, sneeze, I'm going to catch all their bugs. In Buddhism, we encourage sharing. So we share bugs, share everything. What was that? I don't know. Anyway, so don't worry about sneezing. Dear Ajahn, when forced to meditate at high-level platforms in tall trees or cliff edges, one stupor or laziness hindrances will likely be overwhelmed by other hindrances, namely fear or worries. Exactly. So it's not a good thing to do. I just said those as examples. And it means you can meditate on a platform out of fear, but when you come into a nice hall like this where there's no fear at all, of course people can't do it anymore. So under these circumstances, how does one attain deep meditation despite the heightened alertness or mindfulness with the rush of fight flight hormones? Thank you. It is because you know, just like my mosquitoes, you had to do the meditation properly. So, you know, you weren't messing around, you weren't being lazy anymore. You followed the instructions. Otherwise it was death. While I meditate amidst waves of pity, that's more wonderful, pity of joy, I find it difficult to step out of the meditation when I've had enough. Haven't had enough? There'll be some people here would just be, they'd give thousands of dollars to get waves of pity, and you've had enough? Come on, just give me more waves of joy. Why can't you say have enough? It takes quite some time to pull myself out. Don't try. As if my mind doesn't want to leave. Exactly. Don't spoil it. You're having a great time. So why do you want to take yourself out? Just carry on and go deeper. Sometimes it is the fact that people think that joy is something wrong with it, or you don't deserve it. There used to be this religion called Puritan Christianity. And somebody had this wonderful definition of the Puritan strand of Christianity. It was the fear that somewhere, someone is happy. And it was any joy and happiness was beaten out of people. And it was wrong. You had to suffer in this life. And when people are having a good time, there must be something wrong with that. So that was really weird and strange. But we still have a residue of that. We feel guilty. I'm happy, but there's many other people who are suffering today. So I don't deserve to be happy when other people are suffering. I should go out there and suffer as well. Well, at least there's a few people who aren't suffering, so that's something. So also we think, oh, maybe I don't deserve to be happy. Because you've been told by your parents, usually your mother, you're not good enough. You're stupid. That, you know, you're not a good person. You could do better. And it's really weird, isn't it? I mean, you go to school and, you know, you get top of the class. You can do better than that. Because you go to a bigger school. You can do better than that. You go to university and you get grade A's. You can do better than that. And you get a first class degree. You can do better than that. Get a master's. You can do better than a master's. Get a PhD. You can do better than a PhD. Get a Nobel Prize. You get a Nobel Prize, get another one. So some people are never actually satisfied. And people actually feel that. No matter how successful you are in life, you're still not good enough. No matter how deep you go in meditation, you feel you're not good enough. You should go deeper. Only first jhana. How long have I been teaching you ping pong? Is that all you've got for me? Just first, that'd be wonderful, wouldn't it? So sometimes that people are like that. They've got this lack of self-worth. And I think that might be why you think you've had enough. Just enjoy it. Go deeper and deeper. It's good for you and it's good for others. Could you please explain again the simile of the will as the house builder? I don't fully understand. Thank you so much. It is the will which creates your world. Your house, you wanted to build it, you wanted to buy it. Your career, who are you? Social worker? You are a doctor, an engineer, you had to will yourself to do that. Your body, bodybuilders, Arnie Schwarzenegger, he wasn't built like that. He willed himself to get those big muscles and a small brain. Oh, sorry, I should have said that. He might beat me up. And you see, like, one of the biggest wills, Donald Trump. You know, you think he willed himself to have all these incredible resorts and Trump Tower. What the hell does he want to be president of the United States for? Hasn't he got enough? Because what happens, once you've got wealth, the next thing you want is power. Power, not just to exert your will over your own body, but your will over your relations and the people who work for you, and then the will over others. And the will just knows no bounds. You want to have the will all over the United States. And when he dies, he'd probably stand for election as God, if he could. But that's a problem, that the will has no end to it. You always want more and more and more. So it builds houses, and most importantly, it builds your next life, your rebirth. Why do you get reborn? Because you want to. Where do you want to get reborn? Do you want to get, all you guys, do you want to become a guy next time, or you want to try being a girl next time? Oh, you girls, have you had enough being a girl? Do you want to try being a man next time? How about, have you been gay yet in all your lives? Maybe try that one. See what that one feels like. There was this disciple here, Australian, Caucasian. And when I was chatting to him, he said he wants to be a dog in his next life. I couldn't believe what he was saying. What do you want to be a dog for? And he said, look, I expected better of you, Ajahn Brahm. You're wise. Think about it. A dog doesn't have to go to work on a Monday morning. You do. A dog doesn't have to worry about paying the bills. You do. A dog doesn't have to worry about looking after kids. You do. A dog doesn't have to worry about cooking the meal or even cleaning his dishes like you have to do here. Just people put food in the dog's bowl, he licks it, and that's good enough for the dog. Other people have to wash it for him. And what does a dog do all day? sleep. Any dogs never feel guilty sleeping a lot. You do. People come up in the interviews, oh, I must have something wrong, I've been sleeping too much, I feel terrible about it. The dog never feels guilty like that. He just sleeps. Dog never thinks too much. I've never seen a dog get frustrated. I've seen you guys do. Or get jealous. So he said, a dog, especially in a Western world, yeah, you get pampered, free health care. All you need to do, only work you need to do is, you know, just to take your owner out for a walk in the morning. No, it's not the other way around. And just be patted and lick somebody every now and again. That's all you need to do. That's your only duties. So it'd be great, be a dog. And you know what I said to this guy? Because I knew his character. And said, don't you realize in a place like Australia, after a few weeks as a puppy, you're taken to the vet to get de-sexed. And he stopped in his tracks. And he said, oh, I never thought of that. And he said, I don't want to be a dog anymore. Because he liked his sex. So anyway, but if you wanted to, and you had the karmic wherewithal, then that's what you become. You build your next life. What you want. Even in, remember Plato's Republic, the old philosopher, Greek philosopher, he's just saying that, you know, they had also had reincarnation. You go to the Elysian fields after going over the river Lethe, forgetfulness, and you hang out in this Elysian fields for a while, and then when you want to get reborn again, you can choose whatever rebirth you want. And then you go over the river Styx, and then you get into your next life. And that was the ferryman taking you over. That's where that one comes from. And he was saying very wise words. You know, Plato was a pretty smart cookie, Greek guy. And he said that, you all know that Plato was Greek, but he said that the stupid people, they chose rebirth to be rich and famous. He said they were the stupid ones. The wise ones, it was middle way. Not too poor, not too rich, not too famous, not notorious, just in the middle, so you can live a nice, peaceful life without being sort of in the forefront of things. So that's the house builder. You want it, and you get what you deserve, what you wanted. You build your life, what you want. Oh, there was this poem, I put this in, Opening the Door of Your Heart. It's a very lovely poem by Sung Po, a very, very wise Chinese poet a long time ago, many centuries ago. And it was a poem to celebrate the birth of his son. And it goes something like, most parents, when they give birth to a son, want their son to be intelligent and smart. But I, said the author, through intelligence, have wrecked my own life. So I want my son to be stupid, so he can live a tranquil life and at the end of his life become a cabinet minister. Because he's stupid. That is a very sort of satirical, cynical poem, and I thought I'd love that. That was so many centuries ago. So if you're really smart, you have too many responsibilities and too many headaches. Do you want to be smart? Or tranquil. And if you really want to be in politics, of course you have to be dumb. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned that in the first jhana the will is still loitering. Is the will trying to grasp or own the bliss of that state? Yeah, well done. The bliss is there, but because you're grasping it, it becomes unstable. But the bliss is so strong, it pulls you back in again. It's the wobble of the first jhana. Very good. What the difference between genuinely joyful and happy as opposed to scattered, restless, and seeking attention and affection all the time? How to know when happiness from wholesome and when from unwholesome? If it's really joyful and happiness, you don't seek anything. You're content. So real happiness means, what do I need? I'm happy. So you're not scattered. Scattered means you're looking for something else. A scattered mind is usually because of suffering. So you're not restless. Real happiness and joy. Oh, you're just happy to be here. You don't need anything. Totally content. Satisfied. Dear Ajahn Brahm, what is the difference between us sitting here watching the breath and hens sitting on their eggs for hours? That was Ajahn Chah's simile. When someone asked him, do you need to meditate for hours to become enlightened? And he said, if that was the case, that hens who sit on their eggs for many, many hours without moving would all be enlightened. But we all know that chickens are not arahats. So between watching the breath is the breath becomes beautiful and then disappears. For the hen, the eggs never become beautiful and they're still there poking into your ass for hours. So it's very uncomfortable. But for you, if you watch the breath properly, it actually disappears. That's the difference. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is Ajahn Sujato coming back to Bodhinyana? Who knows? Not even Ajahn Sujato knows. So, that is one of the unanswered questions. And anyway, why do you want to know? If I told you, it wouldn't be exciting anymore. It's just like when, you know, you look at a book and it's some sort of crime novel and you go to the last page to find out who did it. That would not be exciting at all. Or you're watching a video of a cricket match and instead of having the enjoyment of who's going to win, you go to the news and you find out what the winner is. I remember that we had two caretakers and there was a cricket match, I think it was Australia versus Sri Lanka, a one-day match. And they, you know, it was a Saturday afternoon after the meditation. They couldn't watch the match on the TV because they had to do their job as caretakers, but they recorded it on the TV. And so after Saturday evening, after looking after the monks went to do their meditation, they met and they watched a cricket match. And it was really close. It came down to the very last ball. Only something like 2 runs to win. And the TV went black. Because they only actually recorded it for so many hours, 3 hours, and it was an overrun. And it's only one ball. And because they hadn't watched the news, they had to wait till the following morning before they found out who won. So much torture. I said, what does it matter who wins? It matters. So when is he coming back? Who knows? Wait and see. It's exciting. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in Bodhinyana Monastery in Buddha Temple, foundation stone has the Enya from 1987 to 2350. What does it mean? Does it mean that you know the end year of the monastery? That's the end of the world in 2350. So it doesn't matter, you've got a long time left yet. Because it's predicted, 1987 to 2350. And monks don't lie. What it means is 1987 was the day those stones were installed. That's the Western calendar. And this is the Buddhist calendar, 2350. You add 543 on the end of the Roman calendar, whatever it's called, and you get the Buddhist calendar. So that was 2350 BE, the Buddhist year. Actually, they got it wrong there. It's 2530. Someone's got dyslexia here. I hope you're not an accountant. Other than that wasn't you, Ananda, otherwise all our accounts are just really... I wonder where all that money went to. So it's 2530. It's a Buddhist year. That's all it is. Nothing like that, unfortunately. What are the suttas that breaks down and explain components of each factor of the Eightfold Path? For example, the Koma components, Sama Sankapa, Anekama Sankapa, Awaya Pada Sankapa, Hingsaka Sankapa, and you missed out. Oh, that's right, yeah. Sama Samadhi First Jhana. Oh, this is so many suttas which break it down. Just look at Mahasachaka Sutta. So there's so many places where they explain the Eightfold Path. So to think of one particular one, just Mahasatika 1 is one. Even the Satipatthana, they have it in there. So many, many suttas where they break it down. Because it keeps reoccurring again and again. It's core Buddhist teaching. Is jhana a state of mind? Of course it's a state of mind, because the body has gone. After one has achieved jhana, will his or her personality or perspective of life change? Of course it does. It's a powerful, as one of our members once said, it's like a real kick up the bum. You know, to actually dislodge wrong view, to see things again, you need something quite forceful to see things in a totally different way. So yeah, for a few days, you're just like you're upside down. But if the jhana wasn't strong, then that new way of seeing things gets soon overwhelmed by your old habits, so it passes away. So it doesn't always lead to enlightenment, but it gives you a few days of really seeing, wow, what's happening here? Will jhana disappear if one does not continue to practice meditation? Of course it does. It has its causes, and if you don't maintain those causes, it vanishes again. So it doesn't make you enlightened just getting jhanas, but without it, it becomes impossible. Ajahn Brahm, is the Buddha Tooth Relic in Singapore a good place for deep meditation? I saw articles where they had photos of the Tooth Relic Temple in Singapore, and there was a professor of dentistry who said that is actually looks much more like a tooth of a cow. And that's what they said. So is it really the Buddha's tooth relic in that temple? And that caused a lot of problems. People were very, very upset because people donated millions and millions and millions of dollars to build the Tooth Relic Temple in Singapore. But if you had to take a picture of it, it's a huge thing. And if that was, it'd be out here somewhere if it's in the Buddha's mouth. But trouble is, you know, people get very upset and angry at you. I can say such things, you try saying such things, and you're put in jail in Singapore. The relics of the Buddha. What are the relics of the Buddha? Are they bits of teeth or blood relics? Blood relics. The Buddha was cremated. Blood burns. What are the relics of the real relics of the Buddha? Are the Dhamma. The teachings. In the Dhammadhyata Sutta, the heirs to the Dhamma. He said, do not be an heir to my material stuff, like physical bone relics. He said, be an heir to my teachings. That's what I give you as your inheritance. But people love worshipping relics, but actually looking at the Dhamma and practicing, that's a bit hard. So, the real relics of the Buddha is the Dhamma, the suttas, the teachings. And how many of you have been on pilgrimage to India and seen the four holy places? No, you haven't. You've been on pilgrimage to India, but you haven't seen the four holy places. The four holy places where the Buddha lived, first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's where the Buddha, his mind, lived. You go to these other places, that's where his body hung out. That's not where the Buddha lived. So you don't need to spend all that money going to India. All you need to do is come here, get jhanas, 1, 2, 3, 4, and you've been on pilgrimage. That is actually almost coming from the Mahahatipadopama Sutta. The simile is the elephant's footprints. We say if you're looking for an elephant, you know, just because it's a footprint doesn't mean an elephant is there. Could be something else. And if you really want to find the footprints of the Buddha, where the Buddha actually is, or lived, first, second, third, fourth jhana. Why are arahats usually depicted as skinny men with overgrown eyebrows, etc.? That's in the Mahayana temples. Basically, look a little strange, not like Buddha who looks contented and perfect. Is it because they are not fully enlightened? No. It's just interesting. You see the Buddha, he's got this flame coming out of his top of his head. If he hasn't got a flame, he's got a bump on top of his head. And when we commissioned the Buddha statue in Bodhidharma Monastery, we wanted to be more realistic. And look at his hair. It looks like an afro. But, you know, curly hair, that's what, you know, African Americans have. So, like Obama. But the point is here that we wanted just, they're supposed to be bald, shaven head, and no bumps on it. We tried that, and then the artists, the sculptor making the Buddha statue, told us, no, we have the bumps, it signifies something. It's not how the Buddha looked. It actually represents, this is how we know it's a Buddha, because it's got a bump or a flame on the top of a head. And they have other images which they dig up in India, and it actually hasn't got the bump, so they realize that's not a Buddha statue. All it is a symbol which defines as a Buddha rather than any other monk or any other being. So that's why the arahats are depicted as, they're not all skinny men with overgrown eyebrows, etc. That's just some Mahayana way of looking. I think it was Bodhidharma, really fierce, and his eyeballs were just popping out of his eyes. It looks really weird, because he was supposed to have cut off his eyelids, so he didn't get sort of sleepy. So that's one way. If ever you've got any sloth and torpor, traditional, just get... that's what they said anyway. He was an Indian monk, but he went to China. So that's not really true. Thank you. This retreat center and experience has been super. Even the toilet paper is oh so soft. We think of everything here. Dear Ajahn, one of the paramis we need to develop is determination. It's aditana. How does it work? How strong determination affects our behavior? Afterwards, do we sometimes need willpower to do what we determined to do, like keeping precepts? Those paramis, they came after the time of the Buddha. But what happened? The Mahayana, instead of having an eightfold path, they had six paramis to develop to be a bodhisattva. So only six. And then the Theravada, who was, you know, trying to keep up with the Joneses, so then they had parameters, but they had 10. Nah. We've got more perfection than you have. So it was really stupid stuff. But it's after the time of the Buddha. Parameters. Dear Ajahn, how are the monks looked after during illness? I mentioned this earlier. When I was very sick, Ajahn Chah set the standard. He came to see me in hospital. You know, we care for people, we visit them. We teach them Dhamma, though. He came up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, you'll either get better or you'll die. And he went. So that is how we look after people who are sick. Oh, you either get better or you die. So what's the problem? No, the people who are sick, they get sent to doctors. Are they covered by medicine, or can lay supporters offer medical expenses? How can a lay supporter do this? No, we have Medicare here in Australia, and if a monk hasn't, because they're a visiting monk, they always have to, before you get a visa, you've got to have a medical insurance. So all the monks have got medical insurance, either for Medicare or for something else. And as for me, when I go overseas, I don't have health insurance when I go overseas. That's dangerous. Absolutely not dangerous. If I get sick, there'll be so many people in Singapore will be so happy. They can make merit with me. And there'll be doctors. They'll be fighting. They'll be having fist fights. No, he's going to my hospital. No. My hospital. No. I want to look after him. Because my insurance is my good karma, my kindness, my service. And I've been looking after other people for such a long time. If I get sick, people really look after me. And this is absolutely true. It happened years ago. I haven't done this since. I've been in very good health. I coughed during a Friday night talk. Just and by the end of the talk, a few people actually went out during the talk. had all this medicine in front of me. And this, honestly, this is what happens. Somebody comes up and said, Ajahn Brahm, homeopathic medicine, this really cures, it's really good for me, you must take this. And they really pressure me, say, okay. And then someone else comes up, Ayurvedic medicine, this is the best. Take this, it cures your cough. It cured my grandma's cough. And then somebody comes up, no, this is really good stuff, I just herbal medicine, really good stuff. You must say, okay, I've just got this from the chemist, it's recommended by doctors, it's really good for, you know, Western medicine cough. And but after about 5 minutes, I've got 6 or 7 different bottles of medicine, which they forced me, cajoled me, put pressure on me to take, and I say yes. Then I have to keep my promises. If I make a promise, I keep it. So I have to take all this medicine, I took all that medicine, and now I was really sick. So that's why I daren't cough in public. If I cough, I wait to go outside. I cough in private, when no one can hear me. So you can leave me alone. So, in Australia, you don't really need to do that. We have dentists you usually have to pay for. That's not covered by Medicare, but we've got so many dentists look after us. And, you know, free dentists. And, you know, the trouble is that the one who looks after my teeth, you know, used to be the, was he a president? Oh, the last president's husband, Jake. And other people say, come on, we'll look after your teeth. I can't do that. You know, Jake would really get upset. It's just like, I've got one person who looks after my teeth, one person in Malaysia who does my glasses, another one who does my my sandals. Every time I go to Penang, I put my sandals outside the room, and in the morning I've got a new pair. And I asked him last time, what do you know? He keeps them. he could auction them. Or Jake, he doesn't mind me telling you this, my dentist. I had a split tooth once. The only thing was actually you had to take it out, had to remove it. And I only found out afterwards because then he moved his dental surgery to another location. And then actually he fessed up. He kept my tooth as a relic. Because he said, if you really get famous, that's a tooth relic. You know, already mentioned a tooth relic in Singapore. He said, yeah, this is important stuff. And there you go. Yeah, that was his like superannuation, his retirement fund. And don't laugh at that, because I told you my meditation cushion went for $30,000 US in Hong Kong. Imagine a tooth. But you know what happened? Because, you know, bad mind states, that sort of when he moved his surgery, he lost it. It disappeared. So, you know, he keeps saying, can you come to my surgery again? I think that tooth needs to be removed. So I'm a bit careful of going to that dentist. Okay, that's after we looked after too well. Dear Ajahn Fluffy, how do you like your mushy peas? From fresh peas, dried ones, how did your mum make them? With super meta Mrs. Fish and Chips. Oh, we've got a couple of people who make really good mushy peas. Actually, that's why there's two people in my mushy, like my sandals person, my aircraft flights person. My mushy, two people make my mushy peas. So don't make mushy peas, otherwise, you know, they've got nothing to make anymore. So that position has already been taken. It's good fun sometimes, being a monk. You mentioned last night we are good enough. Exactly, but my boss always said this is not good enough. But that's good enough. It's good enough that he said it's not good enough. That is not good enough. What can I do or think when my boss keeps saying that? You say, that's good enough. If I can't confront with her because I may lose my job. If you lose your job, that's good enough. Yeah, you lose your job, you might get a much better one. Dear Fluff, well, another fluffy Ajahn Brahm. It's amazing. Sometimes, you know, you have sort of synchronicity. Dear Fluffy Ajahn Brahm, when I meditate, I feel really bored. Excellent. I try to focus on my breathing, but then I become bored again. I don't mind feeling bored as I can sit still for 2 hours without moving, but during the 2 hours, I feel bored. However, when I feel bored, I feel peaceful. How can I overcome my boredness while still maintaining the peace? Thank you. Boredom. You know, I've looked through many psychological journals, and no one has really investigated boredom. So this is your chance. While you're on this research, do intensive, on this retreat, intensive research on boredom. Take notes. Find out what it's really like. Does boredom, is it just boredom, or is it intense boredom, medium boredom? Is there many different types of boredom, like many flavors of ice cream? You know, what's the flavor of boredom today? And just know, how does it affect your body? Does it affect your mind? What's the side effects of boredom? And so really make an intensive study and then write it down and send it to the Journal of Psychology, Australian Psychology Journal. And, amazing, you'll become famous. The expert of boredom in Australia. You'll go on all the TV shows and you'll be invited to conference to present your paper on boredom. And it's the most easy thing to talk about. You just sit there and you don't say anything interesting. So, boredom is one of the most interesting subjects. And as soon as you show an interest in being bored, then boredom is gone. So it's not what you experience, it's how you relate to what you experience. As I don't know if they've still got their, where's that, got the t-shirt on? Make peace, be kind, be gentle with boredom. Be kind to it. Boredom, thank you, no one likes you. You're just like that little at the little spider you took out. Boredom is like a spider, no one likes boredom. And I always like to stick up for the people or the beings that no one else likes. So boredom, you're my friend. Or we can have boredom rights, like you have rights of children, rights of animals. We should have boredom rights so no one actually just stigmatizes boredom or discriminates against boredom or diminishes the importance of boredom. And so once we actually give boredom like a facelift, like a makeover, then people love boredom. What's wrong with being bored? So that's how I would say, just enjoy your boredom. Make it interesting. Dear Ajahn Brahm, do you know who Ajahn Jnana Dharma is? Oh yeah, I know who he is. He is a person who wrote the short book, Walking Meditation, thank you. And as I told people in a Wednesday night talk recently, he was an old friend who went over to Thailand and one of the people who kicked me out of Wat Pa Bong. But do I hate him? Do I want to take revenge? Do I want to curse him with a Buddhist curse, Namo Tassa, chanting backwards? That's not a Buddhist curse. No, I have just wonderful memories of him. Great friend. Wonderful stuff we used to do. For example, it was Arkatina Day. Some of you may remember this. Arkatina Day over in Bodhinyana Monastery. And I was trying to encourage more donations for something or other. So I told the story of the priest who hypnotized his congregation. He had just started off in the religious business, and we all need money to pay the bills, but he wasn't getting enough money in the donation box, so he went to see one of the senior monks. And the senior monk said, this is how I did it when I started off. Where do you give your sermon? Close all the windows of the hall. Turn up the heater. Make it really hot and stuffy. And then give a boring talk. I mean, really boring. In a low monotone. Until everybody starts falling asleep. But before they fall asleep, get out your watch and swing it backwards and forwards until everyone is hypnotized. And once they're hypnotized, then you tell them, No coins in the donation box. No fives, tens or twenties. Only fifties and hundreds. And he said, I can't do that. I said, of course you can. It's good karma. You're encouraging people to make merit. What's wrong with that? So he tried it. And it worked. The donation box was stuffed with fifties and $100 bills. He cleaned up that day. But he thought, I better not do this every week. They'll soon find out. So he waited in until he needed some more money to pay the bills. And then, before the talk, he closed all the windows, turned up the heaters, and gave boring talk again. And when they were about to fall asleep, he got out his watch and started to swing it. And that's when he dropped his watch. And at that point, Ajahn Yanadamo pulled out the plug of the microphone so I couldn't give the punchline. Such a prude. And I say, I've been muted. I can't carry on. And I it was really funny. I always remember him for that. But if you want to know the punchline is, I said, he dropped his watch. And because he dropped his watch, he swore, oh shit. And because everyone was hypnotized, that's what they did. And it took them a couple of weeks to clean up the hall and get the smell out. And as I was about to tell that, Ajahn Yanadamo stopped me. But it's happy memories. So I don't allow two bad bricks to stop me liking my friends. Thank you for your Q&A yesterday by saying, may all living beings be well and happy if they want to. In the past few years, I realized that some people choose not to be happy, mainly for self-pity and to gain more attention. And I always tend to please them and sacrifice my own happiness. Excellent. Now I am free. But there is no reason to hold my own happiness. No, to hold back my own happiness. I agree with you. But you can hold back your own happiness if you want to. I'm not going to force you. Okay. Dear Ajahn, with the utmost respect, when a question starts like that, it's usually a complaint. With the utmost respect, could you please explain again why Buddhists care for all living beings but eat cows, lambs, pigs, etc., who are kept under very cruel conditions? If all Buddhists stop eating meat, then the world could feed itself. It takes much water grain to make 1 kilogram of meat. That is true. If you can be a vegetarian, please do so. But it's not just eating meat which causes, you know, a lot of problems in the world. There's so many other things, mostly greed, anger and hatred. If everyone was a vegetarian, there would still be, it won't be the case like everyone becoming a monk or becoming a nun. There would still be a lot of wars, exploitation, rich people exploiting other people. So there's many, many things. And I often say that one of the things which you can do, no one can be perfect, but you can do whatever you can and lessening the amount of things we consume, not just animals, but also wood and bricks and concrete, by having smaller houses, learning how to live together in peace and harmony, trying to make bridges between people of different ideas and faiths. So there's much more to it than just one thing. So we do care for all living beings, each in our own way. Dear Ajahn, can you please recommend a few great and inspiring Dharma teachers like you? Apart from you and Ajahn Brahmali, I do not know any other inspiring teachers, so please suggest a few. Aya Upeka, Venerable Analia, over there, sometimes, and Venerable Posada. These are inspiring. They may not give Dharma talks, they may not open their mouth, but isn't it inspiring to see them sitting there so peaceful and quiet? So to be an inspiring teacher is not just by what you say, it's by who you are and all the renunciation they've done. Wonderful. So you are inspiring. Do you agree? Yes. Yeah, there we go. So I recommend them. Dear Ajahn, if there is no self, not my direct experience of this time, what exactly is reborn when you die? The stream of consciousness, your delusion of a sense of self, keeps the process going. As long as you look in terms of an experience, in terms of a sense of self, then that experience will continue on. It's delusion, not seeing things in the right way. And that causes your will. When you think there's a self, you will. And it looks like there is a self. So that's actually what is reborn. The process is reborn. Ajahn, I experience fear of being hurt going into religious places due to war and politics. How do I overcome this? Really? I saw the lights of Jhana state close the... Also, the lights at Jhana state close the lights, not turn off the lights. Please explain why. Wow, I don't know, quite understand what you mean here. But anyway, experience of being hurt going into religious places due to war and politics. But there is no war in Jhana Grove or Bodhinyana. There is no politics in Jhana Grove or Bodhinyana. Maybe in the Buddhist Society of West Australia there is. You've been on a committee before. But, you know, here there's no stuff like that. So religious places like this, you can feel the energy is nice and peaceful. So you feel the place. And when you feel the place, instead of thinking about it, you know it's safe. Also, the lights at Jhana state close the lights, not turn off the lights. Please explain why. I don't understand. I can't understand that. You've got me. You stumped me. I don't understand what you mean, so I can't answer it. But that question there, if I can't understand the second part, so if you'd like to rewrite it, I'll try again tomorrow. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can you kindly tell us a story? No. Next question. I've already told you a story. Are you telling stories? Yeah, okay, well, somebody said that anyway. I didn't. Did I say it was you? Da 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 da. I have had difficulties with law and society. I also have received many misdiagnoses from doctors in regards to mental health. I know I'm a good person, but how do I trust myself and others completely and be at peace? Sometimes, you know, other people, whether it's law or doctors or other people, they all try their best. But sometimes that we have conceit, we think we know. So even when some of you come up and you say this experience and that experience, you always leave a little bit of doubt because you're the only one who knows. And I often say that doctor, professor of medicine at Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney, last year of his career, about to retire, and he told medical students, welcome to Royal Prince Alfred Medical Hospital. Next 4 years, you're going to be studying here. And he said, the next 4 years, what we're going to teach you, 50% is wrong, he said. He said, my problem is I don't know which 50% it is. And that was just such a memorable. I really respect somebody like that. I understand that whether it's law, whether it's medicine or psychology, it's always work in progress. And we always, sometimes we think that we have to be certain. But the greatest doctors say, well, it may be a jhana, it may be this, it may be something else. But they never tell you it's certain. If they do, that's conceit. So sometimes that's a problem. They always say, especially with lawyers, never trust a two-armed lawyer. Only one who's only got one arm. The reason is because the lawyer will say, well, on one hand this, on the other hand, if they've only got one hand, then it's much more clear what they're saying. You said in jhana, body doesn't get burnt even by heavy fire. Is there science to it? Science is they don't go that far. Science is about stuff. But jhana is about the mind. Totally different world. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is sleeping the same as meditating as when sleep? It feels the same as meditating. Can people get enlightened while sleeping? If that was the case, you'd all be fully enlightened by now, the amount of times you've slept on this retreat. No, it's not the same. In sleep, you've got more mindfulness. No, when you're in meditating, you've got more mindfulness. Lastly, can you tell the story where the mum's ghost spirit came back visiting? Now, I recall you mentioned it before, but I could be wrong. the story where the mother's ghost spirit came back visiting. Any clues? I can remember that one.
An English man, he woke up during the night because he saw his mum.
Oh, that one, yeah. Okay, that was good, yeah. Yeah, that was actually a really nice guy. Some of you may remember him. He was, I don't mind telling his name, Peter Sale. He was from England. He lived just round the corner in Nollamara. And a great little story. He's moved over to Tasmania. Really down to earth guy. He was a ranger in Scarborough, that sort of area. He was a ranger, and that he said that he was at home, sleeping in his bed alone. And he woke up, middle of the night, something was up, turned on the light next to his bed. So it wasn't sort of, in asleep, fully alert, lights on, and he saw his mum standing on the end of the bed. And he told me, he said, knew straight away, because his mother was living in Essex, in England. And he knew straight away, what's my mother doing here? And knew she must have died. And this was a ghost. He said, never ever seen a ghost before. Clear as if she was really standing there. She was standing, smiling, and he never had any fear whatsoever. He said, because it was his mother visiting him. And he hadn't seen her for months. And so he just stared at his mum, in bed, in full light, not for a second, but for many minutes, staring at her as she was smiling at him. He said, one of those beautiful experiences. And then, after 4 or 5 minutes, a long time by ghost standards, and then his mother just vanished, just disappeared in front of his eyes. A very, very clear seeing of his mum. And he felt so privileged to see his mother for one last time, and her smiling, showing her love to him. And that's where, once his mother disappeared, he got out of bed and did what any Englishman would do in such situations. Make a cup of tea. And when Ajahn Chah visited England, when he came back, we asked him, did you learn any English words when you were in England? And he said, yeah. What did you learn? Cup of tea. And that's the only English word he learned, because he heard it so often. Cup of tea. Have a cup of tea. Do you want a cup of tea? Cup of tea. That's the only English, only word in the foreign language Ajahn Chah ever learned. So anyway, Pete had a cup of tea and he was drinking his tea. The telephone rang. It was his sister from England. Essex is just outside of London. And said, Pete, we've got some bad news for you. He said, yeah, Mum's dead. How did you know that? We've only just come back from the hospital. And she said, she's just been visiting me. And I asked him, I put that in one of the books, I think it was Good, Bad, Who Knows book. But I asked his permission, first of all. And I sent him a copy of the book. He said, thank you, because that's just a sweet, beautiful story. And he treasures that, those 5 minutes of being with his mother one last time. He never said anything, just smiling, showing her love to her son, and the son's love and gratitude to the mother, silently. And I thought, it's a beautiful thing. And if ever that happened to you, you'd be so grateful that that would happen. There's someone you love, a mother or father, and they come and visit you. On the other side of the world, just smiling, showing the love. And then after 4 or 5 minutes, just vanishing. It's beautiful. Those are real ghost stories. They're not scary at all. They're just a manifestation of somebody's love to you. They come and visit you one last time. So that was that story. I think it's a wonderful story. And at that happy event, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. And that's all done today. It's gone on to 9:29, so I finished before 9:30, so hopefully that's not too long. And have a wonderful night if you want to. Have a miserable night if you want to as well. Totally your choice. My loving kindness is open, so whichever way it goes, See you in the morning. And if you do die tonight, you can come and visit me at the end of my bed. And afterwards I'll have a cup of tea. Mm-hmm.